What I came to realize was that just like God could have created this earth just to always function in like a greenhouse, always be the same. But even before the fall in the garden, there's already talk of seasons and change. And God made the planet to have to experience change every year. And so what I do is I unpack the four seasons that we know so well, spring, summer, fall, and winter, and look how, especially if you farmed or worked outside, you know that you need all four of those. Now, you may have a favorite season, but you don't get to just always live in your favorite. You have to have all four, and all four have a purpose. And so it really became very interesting to me when I began to look. Springtime is really more for beginnings, and God sort of bursts new dreams in your heart, new opportunities. Even retiring, when you retire, it's actually a new springtime. Whole new opportunity to organize, revamp your life. So being laid off a job, entering the empty nest can be a springtime where you are now free. God wants to do some new things. One of the worst things about life are people that, even though God keeps bringing new springtime opportunities around, they sort of stuck in always doing it the same way. And that their whole life, God could have added a richness to it. Instead, they ended up with pretty well the same life. They sort of squandered their springtimes when they rolled around. Also, winter, there's times where things need to die in our life. We always like springtime, but you can't really have an effective spring if you didn't have an effective winter. But we don't like winter typically. We sort of resist it. And the problem is if things don't die in your life, there's no room for God to bring to birth new things in your life as well. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid when God brings some things to an end, because with God, the amazing thing is no matter how brutal and long and bitterly cold the winter might have been, you always know there's another springtime on the horizon. And if you're in a winter right now that's kind of hard to hold on to, don't worry, because with God there's always a springtime. So I had no idea as I got opening this up just how much there was in there for life, and it began to make sense. And one last thing just to say about that's interesting for us is I would say right now I'm in an autumn season, which is you sort of get to the peak of that stage in your life, whatever stage it is, where you're sort of at the best of that season. It might be parenting, could be as a, you know, could be as a little league baseball player in elementary school, but you sort of hit your peak. I sort of feel like I'm right there right now because of what God's called me to do. But my wife, her calling has been to be a stay-at-home mom. And as has already been mentioned, we just sent our last child out of the nest about 3 weeks ago. So her calling, winter has set in on what my wife's been doing for years. Whereas I'm in harvest time, it's like I'm just so busy I can hardly keep up. My wife is like, do I even have a purpose in my life anymore? And so the interesting thing about seasons too is that you could be married to someone who's not in the same season you're in. And how to bless people who are not in your season and understand why you're in a springtime where everything's so exciting, someone else, a friend of yours, is in winter, everything's shutting down. It really helps to start understanding how to minister to other people. So anyway, I had no idea. It's just been a real interesting journey, this book. Who has an anniversary? Whose anniversary is closest to today? Does anyone get married in? Is there a February wedding here in this room? No Valentine's weddings?
March
1st. Okay. Anyone closer than that? This table, this is the table to be at here, isn't it? I give that to the... Well, I want to share with you again, and this is sort of different. Like, I do leadership stuff all the time. I'm going to go from here. In fact, I should mention, my parents actually are coming in here. My dad and I are doing some leadership training here, Sunday night, Monday. And so you may run into my parents will be here by lunchtime here today. So you could meet my dad if you haven't met him before. I'm going to be doing leadership training. I'm always doing that. Next week, I'm teaching a doctoral seminar on leadership. So I do leadership stuff all the time. Sometimes, I just feel like there's the soft side of leadership that we neglect sometimes. And so that's kind of what I want to talk to you about in both of these sessions. You know, like I said in the first session, I could have talked to you a lot about God doing powerful, awesome things to your life. But sometimes we just have to back up and say, but at the end of the day, it's not about how much you did. It's about how much you knew. How much you knew of him. It's about him. You know, I just was reminded the other day that when the church exploded onto the scene, they didn't go around telling everybody what they believed. They told people what they'd experienced. They had just experienced the resurrected Christ. And it was a personal thing. And they were telling how their life had been changed by an encounter with the risen Christ. And so I don't want to ever forget, even in my leadership role, that it really is about the relationship. And so I want to also talk to you about something else again. And I'm reminded again, one of my favorite stories in our family, you can kind of tell with my family, there's with my kids, they give me fodder for illustrations all the time. All three of my kids have entered the ministry, I think, to retaliate against all the times I've told stories about them. But I remember several years ago, I'd been leading a seminary in Canada for about 12 years, and they decided that they want to thank me for my service. And the school had been really at death's door, and I'd helped pull it back out. And so they're very grateful, and I think they felt like they hadn't really been able to pay me very well in doing that, and so they wanted to kind of make it up to me, I guess. So they gave me a wonderful gift. Never had a gift like this given to me before or since, but they decided to send me and my wife to Hawaii. I hadn't been to Hawaii before, and you have to understand, I was in Canada at the time, and there is no greater gift you can give a Canadian than to send them to Hawaii in January. It was about almost 30 degrees below zero the day that we left Canada. It was balmy when we got there in Hawaii. But shortly after they announced their gift, my three teenage children approached me as a group and said, "Dad, we're very concerned about you." I said, "What are you concerned about me for? I'm going to Hawaii." They said, "Well, that's the point." They said, "We can't imagine how you and Mom could enjoy even a moment of your time over there, all the while knowing that your only three children are shivering in the cold back in Canada, with no one to feed them or care for them." They said, "It'll ruin your entire getaway." And so my romantic getaway with my wife became an expensive family vacation when I now had to pay with my own hard-earned money to bring my three freeloading teenage children with me on this trip. I had planned to rent a sporty little romantic convertible that my wife and I could race around the island with. Now I've got a minivan that I can haul all my kids' luggage. We thought, well, let's get a townhouse by the water. We've never been there before. Might as well do it right. And so we had this little townhouse, and you could go out the patio door, the little sidewalk, and there was the beach. So we pull up in front of the townhouse. My three kids burst out of the van. They're in, and within 2 minutes, they're already running down the sidewalk. "It's Hawaii." And not one child said anything awkwardly like, "Dad, you need help with that luggage." I was like, "You know, that suitcase looks kind of heavy. Maybe I should get that for you, Dad." They're just gone. So I'm hauling, my wife's nesting. I realized that there's no food, so my kids are going to be starving. You can work up quite an appetite lying on the beach that way. So I'm driving around the island trying to find a grocery store so I can buy overpriced groceries for my family. Find one, I'm trying to think what all of my kids want to eat, so I get all this stuff and bring it back. Then I said to my wife, "This is crazy. You know, those kids did not put in one day's work at that seminary in 12 years. They didn't raise any money. They didn't recruit any students. Why are they sunning themselves? Well, I'm just working. I could be working back home. It'd be a lot less expensive to work back there." And I said, "So let's go. Let's go to the beach." So we make our way to the beach. And when we get there, my middle child, Daniel, lazily looks over, sees me coming. He says, "Dad, I am starving to death. What would the odds be of you making me a sandwich and bringing it down to the beach?" Well, let's just say I didn't need a calculator to do that math. But I said, "Listen, I have just spent the last hour and a half getting every imaginable kind of grocery and fun food and junk stuff. It's all there. It's sitting there in the counter in the kitchen. But I said, here's the deal. Feed yourself and clean up after yourself. You're not going to ruin my week, special time cleaning messes up for my slob children all week. So what you mess up, you clean up. But you can have whatever you want to eat." So he goes on back, goes into the townhouse, and sure enough finds the kitchen counter just teeming with all these amazing groceries, finds his favorite chocolate mint cookies. He's so excited, he rips open the bag, starts cramming these cookies in his mouth. He's spewing crumbs all over the floor. Finds his favorite nacho chips. He rips that bag open. He's cramming chips, spewing particles hither and yon. Grabs something to drink, trying to make a sandwich. He's got so much food, it's just falling everywhere. He realizes, "I'll never make it back to the beach with all this." So he thinks, "I'll sit down and eat some of it here." So he sits down on the couch. And now, if you and I, if we had soaking wet swimming attire, we would probably not just sit on the furniture. We'd put a towel or something down first, but he was in far too great of a hurry to do that. So he plops himself down. He's got sand particles spreading over the furniture. There's just a trail of food debris from the kitchen all the way to where he is, still spewing. He sees a TV on the wall. He thinks, well, I might as well see what's on TV. Turns it on, and lo and behold, he finds a hockey game, which Mike, that's his favorite thing to watch. He grew up in Canada. So he thinks, he said to me later, he said, Dad, in that moment, I thought to myself, life does not get better than this. He said, I look to my right, I see the waves of Hawaii lazily rolling into shore. He said, I look straight ahead, I see my favorite thing of all to watch on television. I look in my lap, I see the food of the gods right at my fingertips. He said, I look to my left, I see a strange man wearing nothing but a towel. And he said, in that moment, I realized I was in the wrong townhouse. I tell you what, I gotta say, with my kids, there's never a shortage of illustration. He had gone through the first unlocked patio. He never pays attention. Our question is always, Daniel, did you not notice? You know, but it seemed right. This guy had gotten groceries on his way from the airport, was having a shower, getting cleaned up, when he heard his TV come on, and he's thinking, I didn't think that they, why would someone be turning my TV on? And he gratefully put a towel around himself before discovering my son wolfing down his junk food. We spent the rest of that vacation hiding from our next door neighbor. But it's interesting how quickly you can be on the mountaintop one moment and be in the depths in the next. Isn't it amazing how quickly you could be one moment thinking life doesn't get better than this? It's just so good. And before you put your head down on the pillow that night, it's never been worse. I mean, one phone call, one doctor's appointment, one encounter on a freeway, just so many things can rob us of the joy we had only moments before. And this always kind of seems a little shallow when I talk about the joy of the Lord, because, you know, I could be talking to you about so many things like the vision of moving your organization. I could talk about doing great things for God. But I got to tell you something. My whole life's been spent in ministry, in pastors' homes, around church people, my entire life. And I'll tell you, I think perhaps with 2008 and the economic meltdown and other things that have happened in recent years politically and economically, everywhere I go, I find a bunch of joyless Christians. Everywhere I go. And I can't tell you how many places I've gone where I'll be at a church and the pastor will say, could I take you for something to eat at a restaurant afterward? Now, sure, that'd be great. We'll get to the restaurant and the pastor will just weep his eyes out at how hard it is. And how he's holding on. And I've had ministers say, if I could do anything else, I would do it than this. Just amazing, hurtful things that are happening. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because this is what God has... I'll sort of share a little bit of my journey with you, but what God has been really convicting me of is two things. One is, God has been teaching me that my life is too precious and too brief to squander it joylessly. And I've met so many people that are putting in time, but they're not embracing, thriving, enjoying their life. I had a good friend one time that's kind of an accountability partner to me. He said, Richard, how are things going with you and Lisa? And I said, well, Lou, things are really busy right now, but if we can just get through this particular season of our life, then things should get a little bit better. And my friend who knew me well, who'd heard that response many times before, said, Richard, you don't get through life. Life's not designed to get through it. You savor it. You embrace it. You enjoy it. You only get it one day at a time. It's irretrievable. Why are you getting through? And I'll just be honest with you. I've been a busy guy. I've accomplished a lot in ministry. But a lot of the time I was getting through. I was getting deadlines met. I was getting work done. I was earning a living. But I'll tell you what, God didn't put us on the planet just to earn a living. At the end of the day, in your tombstone, it's not going to write, here lies so-and-so, he earned a living. You know, he managed to pay off his house, you know, whatever, like paid his bills, like he made it to retirement. That doesn't matter. But you know what? There's a whole bunch of Christians, that's what we're doing. We are just existing. I always love what Jonathan Swift said. He said, may you live all the days of your life. And for a lot of us, we only live some of the time. We put in a lot more time where it's just putting in years. Well, I want us to look for a moment at just a couple of passages to lay before you, and then just kind of apply it to you. And maybe I'll just refer to you for a moment. You know this story well. In Acts chapter 16, you know this story. Paul and Silas are in Philippi, and in verse 16 it says that they went to pray. Now, would you not expect that God is going to look upon you with favor if you're going to pray, as is your custom? Like, that's almost a setup when you hear, and Paul's going to go pray as he normally did. You would kind of think, if you're filling in the blank, and God just chose to bless his favored servant who always delighted in prayer. I mean, wouldn't you expect that? You know, you pray a lot, so what do? God blesses a lot. That's how it works, right? So, but as he's praying, as he's going to pray, he comes across a woman, a young girl that's demon-possessed, and these people are exploiting her, getting her to give fortune-telling with these evil spirits, and they're making all the money off of her. They're exploiting this person with demon possession of all things. How heartless could you be to do that? So what does Paul do, and Silas? They set the woman free. They cast out the evil spirit. And so what would you think would happen? What should God do at this point? God should say, not only do you pray regularly, but you cast out demons. You set people free. Wow, if I had a couple dozen more people like you, we could turn the world upside down. You know, you think God would say, so I'm going to bless you. But what happens? The men, the evil men who exploited this woman, lie about them. Say they're teaching evil customs, they're disrupting the community. The next thing you know, the magistrates have grabbed hold of these two righteous men who were just simply going to pray, and now they've stripped them of their clothing, they've beaten them up, they've humiliated them in public, dragged them through the busy downtown streets, ultimately have them flogged and whipped 40 times, almost to the point of death. And then they put their feet in shackles in an inner prison and throw away the key. That is what Paul and Silas get for having been one of the few people making it to the prayer meeting and having set a girl free that was in bondage by sharing Jesus with somebody. Now, you know what? I'll just be honest with you. I've read that story all my life. And I know how it ends. I know what you're supposed to believe about it. But I've been a Christian, like I said, 44 years. I don't know that I'm in the place yet that I could accept that God loves me, cares about me if he let that happen to me. Because we have the mindset, when you do things God's way, he gives you comfort. He blesses you. He gives you what's the desires of your heart. Paul and Silas were not desiring any of that. But of course, you know how the story ends. What do you get by the time you get down to verse 25. They're singing hymns. Acts 16, verse 25. They're singing hymns. That is one of the most challenging verses in the whole Bible for me. I tell you what, someone cuts me off in traffic and I'm not singing hymns, let alone whipping me to the point of death. Someone comes along and tells, when I was starting out ministry, you know, the well-meaning saints come up after you preach your heart out and they tell you, you're going to make a fine preacher one day. You know, all these saints that, you know, you're looking for the strokes, and instead of the strokes, they tell you how you can improve. And you walk away and there's no joy. How could Paul and Silas? I'll tell you, that, right? See, this is what I've always thought about being a mature Christian. Mature Christians are people that spoke in King James. And, you know, they stub their toe, they start blessing a missionary by name or something. It's like, you know, they're just praying in King James. They have these and thous and arts all the way through. And they walk somewhat with a stooped shoulders because they're carrying the burdens of all of lost humanity upon their shoulders. And they have to pray for most of them by name before they can eat their meal each time. And they're super spiritual. But this is what God has really been convicting me of. The really spiritual people are the ones who are filled with the joy of the Lord. They're filled with the joy of the Lord. They're the ones who get. Now I can tell you of some folks, and the other reason this is important, my boys, my two sons actually wrote a book called When Worlds Collide. And what it is they look at the fact that statistics say that roughly 70% of kids who grow up going to church every Sunday, when they hit college, they will walk away. 70% casualty rate. Even though for 18 years, every Sunday, they've watched what you do at church. 18 years of that, won't help a lot of kids get through one semester at a secular university dormitory. And you know, one of the things that for me, as my kids start hitting that age, they start hitting 18, 17, 19, 20, and I realize I can't make them go to church anymore, I can't make them believe in my God, what will it take? And you know what a lot of Christian parents do? They surround their kids with curfews and rules and threats, and say, and we try to keep them away from anything that might entice them away from God and from doing anything evil. And I thought, you know what? I don't think you can make enough rules this today to keep your kid away from evil. Evil will find its way to your children wherever you hide them out. This is what God said to me. If you want your kids to grow up loving me at least as much as you do, if not more, then you help them grow up in a home that is a home of joy. A home that is characterized by the joy of the Lord. Now, I know a lot of kids. I've talked to kids who don't go to church anymore, and I've asked them, hey, I'm not trying to be pushy or offensive here, but you grew up going to church, so why don't you go anymore? I mean, your dad, isn't he like a deacon, an elder in the church? Like, your parents, weren't they like charter members? Like, why don't you go anymore? You know what one of the number one things they'll say? They'll say, yeah, my dad was faithful. My dad was evangelistic. My dad was moral. But there was no joy in our home. There was no joy in our home. Christianity was joyless from what I could see. And I don't want to waste my life being joyless. What God said is, you make this your home so filled with the joy of the Lord, your kids would be crazy to rebel against that. Folks, you can rebel against a rule or a curfew. It's pretty hard to rebel against the joy of the Lord. All right, there's just way too much laughter going on around here. I'm out of here. It's like, you don't do that, you know? And so what God said to me is, so Richard, if you want a home of joy, do you know what you need to have? The joy of the Lord in your life. Let me just share a couple of verses, and then I'm going to apply it for you. One of my favorite verses is Psalm 16:11. The psalmist trying to decide, what is it like when you come into the presence of God? When you walk right into the presence of God, perhaps you stand before the throne of God. There He is. You're breathing the very air that God breathes. You see Him up close. If you're right next to God, what kind of feelings do you think you're going to have? I think you're going to have a holy trembling. I think there'll be a holy fear. I think you'll have a sense of His holiness. I think you'll be overwhelmed by the love that emanates from the God of love. But you know what Psalm 16:11 says? In your presence is fullness of what? Joy. Yeah. When you get right next to God, what are you going to feel? Perfect, undiluted joy. Now, just a couple other verses, and then I'll show you how this works out in your life. In John 15, Jesus is teaching about the vine and the branches. He says, we've got to stay so close to Him. And he basically describes what the Christian life is like. And when he gets to the end of that, he says, and this is why I've told you all about the Christian life. He said, it's for this reason. In verse 11, he says, it's so that my joy can be in you and your joy can overflow, can be filled to overflowing. I'll tell you what, we forget. Jesus, right there, John 15:11, he says, why have I explained the Christian life to you? It's so that my joy will be in you and your joy will overflow. So how can you tell someone who understands what it means to live the Christian life? It's someone who has the joy of the Lord overflowing in their life. Two other verses just to share. One is John 16, verse 22. Jesus is talking about, He's about to be taken away from His disciples. So He says, you're going to be sorrowful for a time, He says. But, He says, this was interesting at the end. He says, but no one, your joy, He says, no one can take from you. Nobody can take your joy. Now, that's one you have to meditate on. You know, because I can see some people, the wheels turning now, saying, well, wait a minute. That can't be true. Because I can think of a number of times where I lost my joy. You know, you don't always have the joy. Sometimes it can be pretty joyless. No, it doesn't say you can't lose your joy. It just says nobody can take it from you. But you see, you can surrender your joy anytime you choose to. And why is it that no one can take your joy away from you? Why is that? You say, Richard, I don't know. Like if you knew the boss I had, you would know there are some joy stealers out in the world. If you had a kid like I've got right now, if you got the physical pain and ailments I've got right now, we'd be a little, it wouldn't be quite so hasty to say no one can take the joy away. But of course, where does the joy of the Lord come from? It comes from Him. So, and who's going to take Him away from you? Nobody. That's why Paul and Silas can be singing hymns after being beaten and thrown in jail. Because those authorities had taken their clothes away, they'd taken their freedom away, they'd taken their health away. They'd taken everything away that they possibly could from Paul and Silas. But what was the one thing they couldn't take away? The presence of God. And so they've got the joy of the Lord still, even though their bodies are racked with pain. But, so then what happens if you're going through the day, you go to work, you have a stressful meeting, traffic is horrible, your kid didn't do what he's supposed to do, and you're on the way home and you're miserable, and you say, well, yeah, but then why don't I have any joy now? Well, in the book, Unlimited God, I say, because we all have a joy threshold. There's a threshold in every person's life where we say, if my discomfort rises above this point, I can't have joy. So if somebody criticizes, if my boss doesn't give me a raise this year, it is impossible for me to have joy. If someone insults me, if someone hurts me, if I've got this back pain that keeps coming back, I can't, that's my threshold. And if the discomfort rises above that threshold, it's all over for me. The joy is gone. Now, Paul and Silas, see, the thing is, I imagine they had a threshold too. It just, their threshold was pretty high. And I think what we need to do is pray and say, God, if you're the kind of person that every time something goes wrong, the joy's out the window, you need to be praying, God, would you raise the threshold in my life to another level? Because I can't, my kids can't keep living in fear that if dad has a bad day at work, it's going to be joyless when dad gets home. God, would you just raise that threshold till I could be beaten within an inch of my life like Paul and Silas, and I'm still singing hymns when I walk in the door of the house. It's possible only by the joy of the Lord. Only God's presence is so powerful, it can counteract a lot of the joy-stealing things that happen in this life. Well, let me give you some examples. Because for me, we know. I mean, if someone crashes into you driving home from here, you know, if you get a call and someone broke in your house and it's burned down, there are things we know right away are going to challenge our joy threshold. But for me, what has caught me by surprise is oftentimes the good things. Oftentimes, I don't lose my joy because I was just robbed. I lose my joy right in the midst of going to church, doing good stuff. Going on a family vacation. Have you ever lost your joy in a vacation? I'll tell you what. You know what? That really is difficult. When my threshold's so vulnerable, I can't even go to church sometimes without losing my joy. I'll tell you. See, this has become my little red light warning signal in my life. If I'm going about the day and all of a sudden I just find myself gritting my teeth and I talk to myself. And I start talking and I'm just like having this big debate about this, talking to this person about how could you be so foolish and to do that. And I think to myself, the joy is gone. You know what I realized? Somewhere during the course of my day, I said, okay, we've hit that threshold. I'm surrendering my joy. I'm giving it up. And the sad thing is that the moment I choose to surrender my joy, I've just robbed my wife of the joyful husband God wanted her to have. I've just robbed my kids of the joyful dad they would have had if I'd held on to the joy of the Lord. So let me give you a couple examples. One, of all places, worship ought to be the most joyful place we ever are, should it not? Because what do you do when you worship? You draw into the presence of God, don't you? And where does the joy of the Lord come from? From His presence. So if you're truly worshiping God, drawing in His presence, you ought to be just overflowing with joy. But have you ever looked around in a worship service and seen joyless people? I'll tell you what, sometimes, you know, it's just amazing. You go into, I'm in a different church every Sunday, and you go into a church, and sometimes I'm looking around, and no one's singing. They're kind of frowning. Like, one guy the other day, like, I wanted to say, sir, you're not worshiping. You look like you're passing a kidney stone. Do I need to call an ambulance for you? Because you look in great distress right now. I mean, they just look pained there in a word. But I'm not going to cast any stones because I've been there. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, I was traveling a lot. One week, I had been in three different time zones, had preached eight times. I'd heard about 8 other sermons. I've been in church all week long. I got delayed getting home. I didn't get to my house till after midnight on Saturday night. Now, my brother was the pastor. I wasn't the pastor of my church because I traveled all the time. So I get home after midnight, Saturday night. I'm jet-lagged, 2-hour time change for me. And I'm thinking, you know what? I know this sounds terrible, but I really don't feel like going to church tomorrow. I mean, I've been in church all week long. I've preached to eight sermons, 3 different, you know, groups, 3 different states. I've heard lots of preaching, lots of singing. That's all I've done all week. I don't need church tomorrow morning. But I realize I've got 3 teenage children and I don't want them to see their dad in bed while they're going to church. It's like eating oatmeal. You know, you do it because it's the right thing to do. And so it's like, I got to go to church because I've got to set an example. So, and that's because that's what I do on Sunday mornings. I go to church. So now you've never probably done that. Gone to church simply because you're supposed to, not because you are hungry to draw near into the presence of God to have a fresh encounter with Him. But so I'm walking into church, and we had a good worship leader, but he had this one song I could not stand. And I mean, part of the song was fine, but part of it was just, you know, I just had this thing. I didn't like the word. I thought the words were unbiblical. And I didn't think that I should have to be made to say things that were untrue in church, even if someone was playing a guitar at the time. Like, I just felt like, if it's not true, I shouldn't have to say that. But the problem was, it was his favorite song, and so we sang it every week. And so I don't even want to be at church. And I'm walking in, and it's like, all right, everybody, let's all together. Let's sing the song that Richard Blackaby can't stand. And so, now I don't normally do this. Normally, I try to be very participative and supportive. But I just didn't have it in me that day. So I decide I'm not going to do this. If he's going to sing this every week, I'm sitting this one out. So I cross my arms. I'll wait for the next song. Like normally what I would do with this song is I would skip the words I didn't like. And then whenever they were singing words I thought were fine, I'd start singing. And so then we get to the parts I didn't like. I would just suddenly look heavenward, like I just heard a fresh word from God or something. I'll get back to that song in a moment. God, what was that you were saying? And then, you know, I'd blend back in. But here, I can't even do that. I'm just sitting out the whole thing. So anyway, while I'm sitting there looking, I'm looking around to see what these other victims are having to endure. Because they're having to still sing. They're not as enlightened as I am. And so, as I'm doing that, my 2 sons, they're like 16 and 14 at the time, they're on the worship team. One's playing the drums, one's playing the bass guitar. They're playing away on this worship team, helping God's people worship Him. And I'm just like, is it hot in here? Or is it just me? I'm starting to feel a little hot here. And so I'm looking around for my daughter. I find her down the row from me. She's singing away. All 3 of my teenagers are worshiping God. This is what God said to me. Now, God doesn't just speak audibly to me. I haven't had Him speak audibly, but He's spoken unmistakably to me a number of times. And in this moment, what God said is this. Do you ever want your kids to look at their dad in a worship service and see him frowning? God just said, Richard, it's not about you. It's not about what you like. It's about me. And what God just said to me is, are you telling me that after all I've done for you, after all I've saved you from, after all I've blessed you with, after all I've protected you from, all it takes is one chorus that you don't care for, and you can't think of a solitary reason to keep on worshiping me anyway. And I tell you what, I just stood condemned. And I thought to myself, God, all it takes is one song at church I don't like for my joy to go out the window. And now that all my kids are looking at Dad. Oh, Dad's unhappy again. They must be doing something at church that he doesn't care about, he doesn't like. I thought to myself, God, I will never, ever do that again. I will never do that again. And God reminded me of a Chinese pastor I'd met several years earlier. He was thrown in prison for 15 years for being a pastor. And most of that time he was in solitary confinement. I had lunch with him when he got out. And it was a dumb question. We're around the circle and it's my turn to say something. And I asked a really foolish question. I just said, well, when you're in jail for 15 years, what did you do on Sundays? Well, that's really a dumb question. It's like, have you ever had something come out of your mouth like, no, pull that back. It's like, no, don't let anybody hear what I just said. It's like, he was gracious. He looked and said, well, a lot of the time I didn't know what day of the week it was. But he said, if I knew, he said, I would just begin to thank God for His goodness to me. And I would just focus on who he was and what it was all about. He said, and sometimes the presence of God would so fill my little solitary confinement cell that he said the presence was almost just too much to bear. And he said, I would just thank God for who he was and what he had done. And as I'm pouting that day at church, God is reminding me of that moment and saying, they took everything away from him, but he still had his joy. You've got a wonderful church, wonderful worship team, climate control. You could bring a wheelbarrow load of Bibles down the aisle if you wanted to study during the service time, and you're telling me one song, that's your threshold, and it's done. I thought I meant more to you than that. By the way, have you ever left it? Don't raise your hand if you have, but have you ever left a service, and as you're walking out the auditorium, you stopped, looked back in, and said, I don't think I got anything out of that today. And when was the last time as you left the building, you looked back in the auditorium and asked, I wonder if God got anything out of what I just did in there? Did the angels of heaven say, hey, come look around here. Look at this guy. Now there is someone who has never lost the wonder of what God did for him when he saved him. He still just can't. So I've just made a commitment that everywhere I am, I'm going to sing out. Now you have to understand, I can't sing. I have no singing ability whatsoever. And so one day, my daughter, who's 22 now, she was with me about a year or so ago. We were at some church I was speaking at for the first time. And in the song service, my daughter keeps looking at me. And finally, I looked and said, Carrie, can I help you? Like, do you need something? I thought maybe she needed to use the restroom and just didn't know where it was. And I said, can I help you? And she said, Dad, are you doing that on purpose? I said, doing what? She said, singing off key on every solitary note. She said, I've heard people miss a high note. I've heard people miss low note. I've never heard anybody miss every note in the entire song. I didn't think that was humanly possible. I said, Carrie, I'm just singing. She said, Dad, I may be 19, but I know singing when I hear it. And what you're doing bears no resemblance whatsoever to singing. I've had people in churches turn around and like, what on earth is that? It's like, I thought there was a Canadian bull moose that just wandered into the lobby bellowing for its mate. Oh, it's just Richard singing. That's right. Oh, so, but you know what? It's like, but I hope that if you would, you know the sad thing with all the worship wars going on right now? Is all the young people are looking at the older folks saying, what a bunch of boring fuddy-duddies. They don't sing. They don't smile. They somehow think they're more orthodox because they sit there grimly through the worship time. The young people, you know why 70% of our kids are walking away? Because nothing they're seeing in church is that attractive to them. And I just had to say, I want, when my kids, if you ask my kids, what was it like when your dad was worshiping God? They'll probably say, he could not sing worth a lick. But I'll tell you what, every chance he had to thank God one more time for what God meant to him. It didn't matter, you could have had an off-key bagpipe player. It didn't matter to Dad. He would just start playing any singing anyway because it was about God anyway. But I'll tell you something. Measure. If you had a camera that just sort of zeroed in on people in your worship service like they do in sporting events and just zeroed in on your look, the way you look as you're worshiping God, then ask yourself, is that what I'd want everybody else to be experiencing? Jesus actually prayed in John 17, I pray that the joy I have would be in them. Would you, if you were praying that for your children, would you be doing them a favor? Well, you know, the interesting thing for me is not just church. I mean, you'd think church would be like a given, that you're going to have joy. But I'll just confess to you here. I've spoken to you long enough now, I feel like some barriers are down here. I can be honest with you. I am a task-oriented person. Do any of you use Microsoft Outlook? Use Outlook or some kind of, system to organize your tasks. You know those when you have those things to keep track of your tasks? You have the date and you have what it is you're going to do and so on. And you have a deadline. And then what does it always have at the end of that line of information? There's a box, isn't there? That box. And that glorious box. What do you do with that box? You check it off once the job is done. Now, for someone who's not a task-oriented person, this means nothing to you. But for a task-oriented person, there's no greater thrill, there's no greater ecstasy than knowing the job is done and reaching over and checking the box. Now, don't admit this if you've done this because you're sick and need help if you have. But have you ever, done, maybe you were home on a Saturday and you did something, you accomplished a task, only to discover to your horror that you forgot to put it on your list. Have you ever done that? You go to check it off, scribble it off, and, oh no, I forgot. Now, don't admit this, but have you ever written it on the list after the fact? I mean, the job's done. The tools are put away. You've dusted, you've swept the floor. There's nothing left to do. You still write on the list for no other reason than the sheer joy of then checking the box. Oh, that feels so wonderful. You know, it's like, well, that's me. So the problem is that we can treat our Christian life like a task. We can treat our walk with God like a task. We can even treat our relationship to our kids and our wife or spouse as a task. And so for me, for instance, I always knew that every summer I had to take a vacation. Now, if it were just up to me, if I were not married with family, I probably wouldn't take a vacation. I would just work all the time. It's an unhealthy thing, I know, but that's just what I'm just kind of work all the time. But I knew I've got to do this. I've got to have a family vacation because I've got to preach a Father's Day sermon next year, and I've got to have an illustration. So I've got to make sure I can cite something I did with my family. But you know, I remember one year we're going to go to California. We're going to drive in our minivan for 2 weeks, and I'm looking at that minivan. 2 weeks we're going to live in that thing. And I didn't normally drive the minivan. I drove a smaller car. My wife did a lot of the shuttling, and so the only time I ever drove in that minivan, I was in the driver's seat. The whole time we had a van, I never sat in any other seat but the driver's seat. And so I had no idea what was taking place back in the bowels of that minivan. I just assumed that they were civilized, non-barbaric people that were sitting back there. But if we're going to go for a two-week trip, I thought, well, I better go back and just kind of keep it clean. I like to at least start out clean, you know, it may end up as a pigsty, but it doesn't need to start out that way. So the night before I'd go back, and I couldn't believe what I was finding. Those little pockets on the sides, you could open it up. I was finding tuna sandwiches and I had plastic garbage bags on every armrest. You never had to even extend yourself to find a garbage bag. But I guess my kids thought, you know, I could throw this rest of the sandwich in the garbage, but I might need it again sometime. I'll just put it in this little nifty little pocket holder here. And the little thing, the juice container things, they would have spilled juice and Coke and it would have fallen out and crystallized. It would be like concrete. And I'd go through an entire industrial strength bottle of Armor All just scrubbing and scraping. I'd get myself hernias with those vacuum attachments trying to get all the junk and the debris underneath the floors that have been ground into the carpet. I'd work for hours. But I'll tell you what, when I was done, you could see a reflection in the dash. I mean, it was sparkling, pristine, clear. And clean. I remember the morning we're going to go to California, I'm there checking everything out. Everything's ready. Everything's polished. There's not a piece of lint anywhere. My kids get in the car. They're like, we're going to Disneyland. This is so exciting. And so then my wife, who missed her calling as a cruise ship entertainment director, she thinks, these poor kids, they haven't had breakfast yet. They're so anxious to go to Disneyland. They're going to starve before we get out of town. So she makes a dozen pieces of toast, and she brings them out. Here, kids, here's something for breakfast. All I can see, of course, is a million crumbs being brought in by my own wife. I said, this sounds really crazy, but I flung myself against the side door. I said, you can't bring those in here. I gave myself a hernia last night, vacuuming up last year's crumbs from the same trip. And I made my kids get out of the minivan and eat their toast in the driveway. And then they had to go through a crumb security check to get back in the vehicle. Of course, you can imagine how much fun it was going on vacation. See, I don't enjoy theme parks. I conquer theme parks. And so, you know, Disneyland, you can stand in line for 2 hours and not even get to the ride yet for a 30-second ride. That's ludicrous. So I had done research. I'd found out which rides had the longest lines, which ones you should knock off first, what shows you get at right times. I'd worked out a master plan. It was all written out. And so that morning, when the alarm goes off, I shout out, all right, everybody, come on, let's go. We're burning daylight. We got a theme park to conquer today. And we won't tolerate any lollygaggers. And so the kids are groggily getting up, and we're there about an hour ahead of time before the gate even opens, right at the front. I said, okay, as soon as they open that door, we're going to go about 50 yards straight ahead. Then we're going to go due east. I want you to go in a hard march. Just follow me behind. Just keep, as long as you see me, just keep going. And my kids would ask all these troubling questions like, well, Dad, like, you know, when are we going to stop and use the bathroom? I'd say, son, bathrooms are for the weak. Well, do you understand? Well, you're standing in line in the bathroom. People, the lines are forming at the next line. That's going to cost you an hour. Just wish you couldn't wait a little bit longer. Well, when are we going to have lunch? Well, we'll have lunch back at the hotel. You see, that's the plan. Well, other weaker families have to stop to eat and drink and go to the bathroom. We could be catching shows and getting on the biggest rides. And by the end of the day, of course, you know, we'd seen every ride, every show, been on every ride. And within a few weeks, my family began speaking to me again, and all was well until the next time. But you know what I realized along the way is that I thought that I looked at my own family as a task. And one of the reasons I always struggle with the term spiritual discipline is because it turns our time with God into a task. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't be disciplined, but I'm saying there's a danger in starting to treat the most important people in your life as a box that you check off when you've gotten it done. And what God had to teach me was, Richard, you can check the box, took family on vacation, but you missed the joy of the Lord that should have been a part of the process. Your family could say, oh yeah, we went on vacations, but it wasn't necessarily fun being around Dad. And God just said, look, the joy of the Lord ought to be just sort of bubbling out within you so much that everybody around you wants to be around your family. Because they understand it's not about how much money you spend on your vacation. It's not about how nice your house is or your car is. It's about, did you have the joy of the Lord? I grew up in a home, probably the most ordinary house in the whole block. But you could hear the laughter coming out of the house all the way down the street. Everybody knew where the action was. It wasn't at the nicest house. It was at the house that had the joy of the Lord. And I want to encourage you with that, because especially in recent days, when I work with CEOs and I work with pastors, when I work with parents who are grieving over things happening in their home, I want to say, you know, I feel the pain. God feels that pain. But I'm telling you, there's not one ounce of pain you felt yet that God's joy is not more than sufficient to overcome it. You can have joy even in the most painful experiences of your life. And I personally think that the greatest apologetic for the Christian life, if we want to be evangelists among the world religions today, you look at Islam, you look at other religions or non-religions, they can be characterized by zeal and many things. The joy is not one of them. Joy is not one of them. And there's just something really appealing about the Christian life when they see that you have joy, even though you're in the same downward economy that they are in, that you work for the same boss that they work for, that you've got physical pains that they don't have, yet they say, but how do you have that joy? I think it's an amazing apologetic of the Christian life, that you can have the joy of the Lord. Well, one last thing just to say, and I'm going to ask you a question or two to just talk about for a moment. But is it possible even to serve God joylessly? So I know lots of people that have been serving in various capacities in their church for years, singing in the choir, teaching Sunday school, serving on the elder board, but they don't have joy. It's possible to serve God and not enjoy God. To be faithful in doing things for Him, but not enjoying Him. And I remember when I left being a pastor, I went to moved to the seminary to be the president, and for several weeks I was new in the area and people didn't really know me. I hadn't had a chance to preach anywhere, and I kind of had these sermons welling up within me that needed release, and my kids weren't that interested in being my congregation. So one day I was delighted when the pastor of the church that we had joined in that area, he called me and said, "Hey Richard, are you in town tonight?" "Yeah." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because normally on this night I would go to a retirement home and conduct a service, preach a sermon for the folks there, but I've been called out of town. I was hoping you'd be in town. Would you mind going and preaching for these folks?" And I thought to myself, can I preach to these folks? I mean, I'm a seminary president. I've got a PhD. I preach all the time. I won't just conduct a little, you know, devotional for these folks. I'll preach mother of all sermons to these people. I mean, a lot of these folks, they're kind of, some of them are a little older, and they probably have a lot of questions about the life to come and so on, and glory. And so I'll in one sermon, I will try to address every issue that they may be facing in life. And I may even do a Greek word study for the word retirement and just work in all of this into one masterful presentation. So I'm trying to put this, oh, fine, I get to preach. Well, my wife calls a little bit later and she says, we're talking. I said, by the way, Lisa, tonight, I said, after we eat, I've got to slip out. I'm going to go minister at a rest home. And she said, Really? You're going to be preaching? Well, maybe the kids and I should go with you. You know, they've kind of missed hearing you speak. And I said, Lisa, no, that's a bad idea. I said, because I know my wife. She loves a party. She's always looking for a good time. And I said, Lisa, I'm not going to be having fun. I'm going to be serving God. And she said, well, I didn't know those were mutually exclusive. I said, yeah, and I know what you'll do, because when I preach, people are going to be coming up asking me questions and seeking counsel, and I can't have you pulling at my shirt sleeve saying that you're bored and you want to go home. I said, it's a policy with me. I don't leave until I've spoken to every person I need to minister to. I could be there for hours. She said, well, we'll bring books. Well, the kids now read while you're ministering to the multitudes. And I could tell that I was not going to, you know, win this one. So I said, all right, but just stay out of my way, because I'm a professional. And so that night, I'm preaching. I've never had a service like this before. While I'm preaching, not one person is looking at me. I mean, I can't see one person's face. Every face is looking this way. Finally, I looked that way, and I realized they're all looking at my kids. My wife had discreetly put the kids over by the wall, but these senior citizens had spied them. There's a woman sitting next to my daughter. She's reaching out, touching the lace on her dress that my mother made. There's two older men a few rows back. They're actually having a gunfight with my two sons. They're shooting at my boys, and there's a rather large woman sitting in front of them. They're hiding behind her, and my two boys don't know. They've never been shot at a church before. They don't know what to do, so they're returning fire, and nobody is paying attention to my sermon. I was so miffed, I brought it to an abrupt close. I never even got to my Greek word. I thought, well, there'll be no Greek for you tonight. You weren't paying attention. And so we closed in prayer. I said, folks, you may have noticed that there's my family's over here if you'd like to visit with them. There's a stampede. There's all these people are swarming over to my kids. They're telling them jokes. They're giving them candies. They're telling them stories. And not one person spoke to me. I'm just like, am I invisible here? Why is it no one's talking to me? This is a swarm of humanity. So I realized, I guess I must have answered every question these folks have. That sermon, even in its abbreviated form, must have been adequate for all that they needed. So I guess my work is done. I guess I can go home. But I can't even get to my family. There's this row upon row of people waiting their turn to talk to them. So I'm wading through. I'm saying, excuse me, sir, can I get through here? Can I get to my family? I finally get up to my wife. I said, Lisa, I'm ready to go home now. And she looked at me and she said, well, Richard, it's just a policy with me and the kids. We don't go home until we've spoken to everybody that wants to talk to us. And she looked at me, I thought rather smugly, and said, you should have brought a book. So while I'm standing there with no one to talk to, all of a sudden I see this very feeble woman. She's got a push cart with handles like this, a basket, and she's pushing it down a very long hallway, very feebly, which would be fine, except that in her basket is my 8-year-old son, Mike. And I can see this woman having a heart attack or hernia, and I yelled at him. I said, Mike, what on earth are you doing in that woman's basket? Get out of there. You're going to kill the poor lady. She goes, oh, it's all right. She said, I told him to get in. She said, I'm giving him a ride, she said. And she begins to push him on down the hallway, and my son is shrugging his shoulders like, Dad, what could I do? The lady told me to get in her basket. Don't leave without me, Dad. Don't go far away, Dad. They get to the end. I say, all right, Mike, get out of the basket. Say thank you. The woman says, that's okay. I'll bring him back, she said. By the time she gets turned around and brings him back, I yank him out. I said, Mike, say thank you. And that was so kind of you. You probably need to get going now. She looked and said, well, I've got to give a ride to your other two children. It would only be fair. And so my 6-year-old son, Daniel, dutifully climbs in. Off he goes. By the time they're bringing Carrie back, they're making announcements from the nurse's station saying all visitors should have left 30 minutes ago. So we're making our way out, we get in the cars, we're backing out of the driveway, of the parking lot. My son Mike speaks up. He says, Dad, why did those people do that? And at first I didn't really know what to say. Finally I said, son, I think that God knew that these people needed joy, and they figured out where to get it. And it wasn't from me. I had ministry for them. I had teaching for them. But what they really wanted was joy that night. And I didn't have that. I was a joyless minister, just delivering more ministry, but the joy of the Lord wasn't there. And I said, kids, I hope that all your life, the joy of the Lord just so bubbles up in your life that it just kind of splashes on everybody you're around. If you go to this church, everybody's glad you're in their church because you splash joy on them. When you go into that Bible study, when you go into that lunchroom at work, wherever you go, may the joy of the Lord just be irrepressible in your life. And may your life be a blessing to everybody you meet. The joy of the Lord. Do you have it? Did you lose it at some point? Sometimes I look at people that are grumpy in this stage of life. You look at pictures of them when they were younger, they had the joy of the Lord. But somewhere, hardship, disappointment, physical problems, any number of things, somewhere along the journey, they surrendered their joy. They used to be known as the life of the party, not anymore. They suffered some hurts. And I don't want to minimize hurts because I've heard some awful ones. I'm just telling you, life's too brief to let a painful experience rob you of the joy of the Lord. God loves you too much to leave you joylessly. And God's saying that to me, and I'm the chief of sinners. I've let some of the silliest things rob me of the joy of the Lord. A dirty minivan was enough for me to spend 2 weeks joylessly with my kids. And I'm looking back and saying, oh, if I could have that time back and realize what mattered and what didn't matter. So many times the things that didn't matter trumped what did. And I ended up without the joy of the Lord. So I want you just for a moment, in your tables, I want you to answer two questions. One is, what is it in my life that tends to be the thing that robs me of my joy? I mean, I can handle all kinds of stuff. This, though, when this happens, I don't know why it is, but boy, I just have so hard having joy when this happens in my life. Share that just as candidly as you would. And then a second question you might answer is this, and what would it look like for my home to have more joy in it right now than it currently does? By the way, if you're grandparents and saying, well, we're off easy here because we send our kids out. Let me ask you this. Is it a fun place for your grandkids to come to? I know grandparents who run their homes like a museum. And their grandkids don't want to come. They're terrified of breaking something and being yelled at. And that's grandma's, grandpa's. Is your home the whole kind of home that grandkids just love the laughter and the joy that emanates through the hallways? And if not, or maybe they do, but still, what might God do in your home so that there was even more joy than there is now? So why don't you talk about that for a moment, and we'll bring it together and we'll have prayer for lunch.
Copyright by the Navigators, 2013, all rights reserved.